And hi to everybody, and welcome to Spotlight. And Spotlight's the program where we find out a little bit, and sometimes a lot, about our members. And I think I'm right in saying that this is unique, because today I'm going to be interviewing not one, but two for the people members at the same time. And they are in Singapore, which again I think is unusual and probably a first. So before I start properly, can I just request that there's no texting during the course of the interview, and if you'd like to ask any questions, please leave it until the end of the interview. I'm sure our guests would be only too happy to answer any questions you do have. I'd like to thank Becky for her support and coordination of the interviews, and to Dennis for recording them. Okay, time to introduce our guests. May I introduce Jaffa and his partner Y.E., and I think you're going to find this very interesting. Jaffa, if it's okay with you and Y.E., what I'll do, being as there's two of you, I'll ask Jaffa a few questions, and to save having to change microphones and stuff all the time, then I'll ask Y.E. a few questions, so that's the way we'll play it, if that's okay with you two. And I'll begin by asking you, Jaffa, to tell us a little bit about your early life, where and when you were born, and just a little bit about your background.
Okay. Hi. Let me see. I'm a Singaporean. I have been a Singaporean all my life. When I was 7 years old, I was admitted to the Singapore. It was then called the Singapore Association School for the Blind. I had my primary education there. I think it would be equivalent to the American system. For my so-called senior school, or we call it over here secondary school, I went to an integrated school where I was in the same class as the so-called normal students, but I would rather call them sighted students, took the same lessons, read the same books, although mine was in Braille, of course, and did the same naughty things, I think.
You mean just was in dots?
That's right, dots. And then from there, I went to college, what we call here junior college, there I took my what is equivalent to the A levels in Britain, and after which I went to LaSalle College of the Fine Arts to take a diploma in composition. Yeah, so that's about it for my education, really.
Yeah, okay. Can we just take you back just a little bit, Jaffa, into your very early life? Can you tell us a little bit about your parents and your brothers and sisters, if you have any, and your early life? What do you remember about your very early days?
I was born into I'm born into a very big family. We have, my parents, they have seven children. And I am fifth in the family, I have but one sister, six boys. But because the blind school then was a sort of a residential school, I think most of my childhood memories were of my stay in the blind school. I did have a chance to, sort of go home. I was staying in a village then, and I did have a chance to go home and, play with my neighbors and climb trees and run naked in the rain. Naked in the rain now, I don't know what you will catch. But in those days, it was fine, it was not so heavily polluted and all that. And, flew kites and caught fish, small fishes from the drains and all, So I can say that my life was quite adventurous in that sense. I also, you know, during my childhood, grew to love music very, very much. I think because my mother could sing, and so I think in that sense I took after her. I learned to play the piano, learned to play the guitar, and learned to sing, and never looked back.
Okay, that's all very interesting. Even I had a bad connection in parts of that. So I hope it holds up for both of us. Now, can I just now ask you to pass the microphone over to YE, and we'll find out a little bit about her early life, YE. Jaffa, so if we just pass the microphone over to YE, and I'll ask you again, YE, if you could tell us a little bit about your early life and your family.
Actually, I set up two microphones, so actually it shouldn't have been a problem. Jaffa has one, I have one. Anyway, for my early life, I was born in 1972. Well, if I said that, then you'll guess my age. Anyway, I was born prematurely, like maybe 4 or 5 months. And there's this condition called, I think it was ROP, was it? That affects, I think, quite a lot of us. Because of that condition, well, I don't have any sight. And, I'm the second child of two. The first one is my brother. And, we are a very small family, but my dad and mom, they work pretty hard to support us. And I mean, I think I have a very good chance in life. I mean, my mom and dad, despite whatever I am, you know, they gave me quite a lot of opportunities to be exposed to the world. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, and you also went to residential school for the blind. At what age do children go to residential school for the blind in Singapore?
I think it was like at the age of 5 or 6. The children in Singapore, yeah, it's about 5 or 6 years old. We went to the kindergarten there. Until we finish our primary school. What would they call the primary school in the US? I think it's like grammar school.
Junior school.
Junior school or grammar school? Junior. Something like that.
Grammar
school. Yeah.
As to your question about at what age are children taken in Singapore, well, it depends on whether the social welfare network is able to locate young children who are in need of education, young blind children who are in need of education and training.
Yep.
I remember in my time, because Singapore was not as developed as it is now, and because, you know, most of us were scattered in villages and such, it was rather difficult. So sometimes people didn't come into primary, you know, into the, you know, lowest grade until they were about 10 or 11 or 12 even. Some people just, you know, skipped school altogether and were just admitted into the a vocational workshop kind of thing. If you were lucky, you were discovered early and you were trained from young.
Yeah.
If not, then, you know. But
I think that's what I heard. But during our time, which was in the 70s, I mean, we were more likely to be referred to the association. I mean,
by doctors.
Yeah, by doctors. So, but at his time, when you were born at that time,
yeah,
I think education for the blind wasn't that
advanced.
Yeah.
So actually, it depended to a very great extent on the period of, you know, of which you were born into.
Yeah.
And some people were recommended by doctors or I social welfare, you know, some people I welfare officer. I mean, some people were discovered and all that kind of thing, so it depends.
Yeah, okay. Can I just request that you don't actually speak together, because it's a little bit difficult to hear you both. I know you're in the same room, and it must be very tempting, you know, to speak as well. But just for clarity's sake, because it isn't the best connection in the world, actually. So, what about education for blind people in Singapore? Is it free? Are people educated free, or do families have to pay? I'll ask Jeff that question.
Okay. During my time, it was free, but when it came to the 70s and the 80s, and I think until now, the blind school, I think they collect a very nominal fee, you know, so-called like for administration charges. However, when you go to secondary school, you know, when you went to an integrated school, you had to pay your school fees. Yeah. See, the thing is, Singapore is not a welfare state, and therefore, unless you have a case, it is very difficult for you to get your education fees paid for. And mind you, fees are not the only problem. I mean, even in terms of textbooks. I mean, we who are blind are very fortunate in that we used to be able to get our Braille textbooks for free, but I think even now we have to pay for the paper. So times change, and you know, we have to adapt.
Okay, all understood there, Jaffa. And why at school? What were your favourite subjects? What did you enjoy doing, and what did you dislike doing?
Ah, very good question. I used to love English, literature, no, stuff like that, but I was always consistent in one subject. And guess what? It was maths. I was consistently failing.
Okay. And were you given any career advice as you came towards the end of your school career? Why are you?
Actually, honestly, not really. As far as career was concerned, we were, I think, if Jaffa can tell you later, I think we're probably left in the dark. We don't really have counselors or something like that, you know, to really guide us through the career path. Yeah, so, you know, we had to kind of, with our own decisions about what to do, you know.
Okay, and what about you, Jaffa? I mean, you said that you'd got a great love of music from an early age. Is that what you always wanted to do? And is that what was suggested that you did do after school?
We do not have a system of counselling here for, you know, a system of career guidance here. I think as far as services for blind people in particular in Singapore is concerned, it is still very backward. There's still a lot to learn, and there's still a lot to, you know, improve upon. And yeah, but we are learning. Things were worse. But I think maybe, you know, with a new generation of teachers and with a new generation of executive leadership, perhaps we will make some advancement. So, you know, we are hoping for the best, and we are keeping our fingers crossed.
Yes, I understand you're developing your infrastructure for helping you know, blind people with their careers in Singapore, and hopefully in years to come you will get some guidance. But you specifically decided, I think, to do music. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. I think in my heart of hearts and in my soul of souls, perhaps I really, you know, really wanted to get involved in music in whatever way I can. In fact, actually, when there was a break in my education, I went to work in pubs and, you know, lounges, and unfortunately, the halls now are closed down. But, you know, I used to, yeah, play the guitar and sing. I used to play in a band. When I was in the university, I used to join my hostel band, and, you know, we were the in thing, you know, we were the in hostel band. Everybody, you know, everybody sort of looked up to us. So, I think, you know, in my being, I've always wanted to get involved in some way or another with music. That was a conscious decision, I think, and I don't think I ever looked back.
And were you classically trained? Have you had any classical training, or do you play jazz, or what's your favorite type of music?
As I was saying, I had a little bit of classical training, but because when the British withdrew from Singapore in 1968, my teacher, you know, my piano teacher had to go back to England, and after that I didn't, you know, advance my classical training, although I would really like to. But since then, I have been playing by ear. I have a very broad range of musical taste. I listen to classical music. I listen to rock. Well, not heavy metal, but, you know, maybe slow rock. And I listen to jazz. I listen to blues. And I listen to avant-garde. So, actually, I have a very wide taste of music. And, well, to me, music is a universal language, and, you know, if your music tells me something, if your song, the lyrics of your song tells me something, then I will definitely be in it, yes, so, you know.
And I believe that you also compose music, don't you? I think we're going to hear one of your pieces shortly. I think Becky's going to play us one of your pieces that she's got on an MP3 shortly. So, can you just give us an idea how you actually go about composing?
Okay, how do I go about composing? Well, I have no fixed way. Sometimes I get the lyrics first, and I build the music around it. On the other hand, sometimes I get the music first, and I build the lyrics around it. You know, I like to learn, try out new things in composition. In fact, I have composed, classical music as well, not only pop. And I had one piece performed at our premier concert hall here, in 2000, I think. And I am very open to concepts, you know. I mean, I do not like to, you know, sort of stick to a technique and say, oh, that's the best. I chip and chop, change and adapt. I learn from many composers and pick up what they have to suit what I want to do. So, you know, I mean, like, for example, I always admired the Beatles, because, I mean, in terms of pop composition, they are definitely the top, so. But I've learned a lot from them, and I've learned a lot from people like, you know, Mozart, Beethoven. I've learned a lot from people like, what's his name, jazz player, Neil Armstrong, Louis Armstrong. I've learned a lot from people of different genres. So. And with my education in music, I have really benefited. Yes, so.
Excellent. Well, I'm not too sure of the title of the piece of music we're going to hear. I'll ask Becky to play it in for us when I've finished speaking. And after it's finished, maybe we could find out a little bit what gave you the inspiration to write the piece. So hopefully the next thing you'll hear, guys, is one of the Jeffers compositions.
Okay, Steve, this is called Walk Unafraid. It's a beautiful song, though.
Whee! Thanks, Becky. That was great. And tell us, Jeff, what gave you the inspiration for that song? I can tell there's probably a story behind that.
Well, actually, the title of this song is based on a poem by Helen Keller called What I'm Afraid. I'm sure everybody knows who Helen Keller is. And actually, this song came about because the what is now called the Singapore Association of the Visually Handicapped, which also was known before as the Singapore Association for the Blind. Well, we were celebrating our 50th anniversary last year, 2001, and you know, I was last year 2002, sorry. 2001, yeah, 2001, you were confused there. Okay, anyway, I was approached to write a theme song for the 50th anniversary celebration. And, I was given this theme to write, you know, base my song upon. And I said, well, you know, one of the things I wanted to do actually is to write a song where we not only celebrate the joy of being 50 years old, but we have also to think of the fact that we have still got many, many things to do, many, many things to improve upon, many, many things to, you know, sort of implement and, you know, many, many people to help, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I wrote my song, you know, based on these things, and so I sat down and wrote the music. You know, I mean, I sort of thought to myself the music had to be catchy, and then I wrote the music in about 45 minutes. But I spent days on the music, I can tell you. I played all the keyboard, you know, all the instruments on it. I played I gathered together a few people, Wai and me and a few friends. We did the recording on my computer at home. So, you know, it turned out okay. Yeah.
It certainly did. Very, very inspirational. I'll have to get you to send it to me on MSN so I can hear it in its glory. And very well done. Very, very nice song. Anyway, Wai, let's come back to you now, because we don't want to leave you out, of course. So, after your school finished, what happened to you? What was the next significant big event in your life after school?
Well, I was actually planning on going to a poly or something, to a polytechnic or college, but seeing that my dad was ill and my brother had a problem too, and I thought, you know, it would be better to support myself than, you know, at least I could support myself by working than, you know, them having to support me as well. So I started working as a telephone operator for like 9 or 10 years. And then I thought that, you know, this work as a telephone operator, it just wasn't me. I mean, I don't know, you know, how long I could take it anymore. I mean, as in sitting down really and doing the same old thing, answering the phones, and, you know, that was all there was to it. And, you know, I needed something more, because I felt that most of my life is based on learning. Even though I was already out of school, I mean, I had to learn something. Like, every day I have to learn something, and this job wasn't fulfilling kind of like my person. So, you know, I just gave it up and started doing music, and yeah, till now.
Yeah, I imagine it can be a little bit boring and soul-destroying, but just out of curiosity, the equipment you use to operate switchboards in Singapore, are they new, modern, up-to-date switchboards, or are they the older type that, you know, probably people would know who were switchboard operators in years gone by, or are you ultra-modern over there?
Oh, the switch box. I think as far as switch box are concerned, yeah, it is pretty modern. But my company, my former company, previous company, was using something called a key phone system. I think you've heard of it before. It's like a system that's smaller than a switch box itself. Actually, I've never really learned to use a switch board, like a proper switch board. But I know that from what my friends told me, they are pretty up to date with the switch board, and there's no like I heard like in the older times you have to take the wires and physically plug in and out, correct?
Yeah.
And physically make sure that the connection is working and stuff like that. I think in Singapore, the what do you call it, communications are very reliable. I mean, I think our companies would want that. So yeah, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. So you decided that being a switchboard operator wasn't for you, and you decided to look elsewhere. And you mentioned music. Was Jeffrey the inspiration for that, or were you always interested in music yourself?
Well, I mean, seeing what he has, I suppose it's nice to have it. I mean, has his talent, so-called, but I suppose I did want it for myself as well, but he does, you know, he does inspire me also, but I suppose it takes a lot of your own hard work to get to a certain place, so, you know, I mean, I'm still learning. I suppose it will never end, the learning, so, you know, I used to take courses like the vocal courses, which was like a correspondent course overseas from the US. I mean, it had its setbacks because of the time drag and you know, and stuff like that. But it did help to build a kind of a foundation for me. And also, I started taking up piano. Like 2-3 years ago. It's basically classical music. You have to read braille music and stuff like that. And recently I started experimenting with pop. I suppose it's, in a way it's much more fun. But you need time to kind of really sit down and experiment and, you know, find out more things and get your ears to listen more. And yeah, even with classical, I mean, I learned to play pop also because of classical music. So I suppose the two go hand in hand in some ways.
Yes, indeed, they do. There's a definite, you know, as Jeff said a little while back, music is a universal language, and it's nice to like and appreciate all types of music. So Jeff, let's come back to you. Do you use a computer to help you with your composing? And if so, just give us a little idea of what you use. Not in great detail, of course, but just a rough idea of how you use a computer to help you in your work.
Primarily, I use Windows. Although recently I have quite taken to JAWS as well, and I'm going to start to learn JAWS, but I started with Windows Eyes. And I use what is called Cakewalk. It used to be Cakewalk. Now it's Sona. These are MIDI and audio sequencing software that I use to sort of sequence my music. We don't say record, it's a sequence. I do all my vocals and stuff on the computer. I also use SoundForge for editing. Actually, I find that if you don't like stick to one particular kind of software or something, you learn as many as you can. You will find that some software is, for example, better in editing. Some software is better in recording or sequencing and all that. So, you know, the thing about being using computer, I think, you know, the secret I feel is to be open and, you know, try to learn as many, you know, kinds of software as you can. I mean, provided they're accessible, of course. And I think it will do you no harm at all.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were going to probably say that you used SoundForge and CakeWalk or Stone as it is now. And I'm sure that lots of people on the site are familiar with those programs. So what do you actually use your musical talents now to earn a living? And if so, what do you actually do?
Okay. Okay, actually, I mean, Wai and I, we primarily, what we do is we are doing busking. We sing on the streets. We busk and, you know, we sing songs and, you know, that is one of the things we do. We sing for functions. I mean, people invite us to sing for parties and dinners. Like, for example, you know, during the Christmas period, you know, the Canadian Embassy invited us to sing carols for them over there, and already our second year. And, well, we hope to extend our, you know, embassy entertainment even further. Apart from all that, we also, do entertainment. You know, we editing work, we edit audio and stuff, and, you know, like sort of, you know, to earn our living. You know, we do mix for parties, and dramas and all this kind of stuff. Well, as I said, you know, anything to do with, you know, music, audio, or anything to do with the arts, in fact, drama, I am very keen to do. And in fact, I've done several large soundscape projects. Like, I think 2 or 3 years ago, we had this guy from Britain who organized with us this project was called The Dream City, where we use sounds of the city to tell a story about Singapore's development and how it came about and all that. So, you know, it's these things are pretty exciting, and I really hope to be able to get involved more in these things.
Now, that sounds really exciting, projects like that. Yeah, I do enjoy listening to experimental things like that, and I think, you know, mixing music and sounds from the city would be very, very interesting indeed. And I think in our preliminary chat that we had a few weeks back now, you did actually mention to me that you also have some involvement in music therapy as well. Just tell us a little bit about your involvement with music therapy.
Oh, well, okay. A few years back, that was when, in fact, before I knew Wai, I used to visit this place called the Singapore Cheshire Home, which is a branch of the International Cheshire Homes. I'm sure there's one in England. I'm not sure if there's any in the United States, the Cheshire Home. And actually what I did with them was I did help some volunteers, some therapists to, you know, sort of organize and plan some musical therapy thing, like getting those hands, people with very weak muscles to hold a very small tambourine and keep it on their knees, you know, and follow the time of the music. I also did music therapy with a friend in a class which comprises mainly of the ESN, you know, the educationally subnormal, and we did a few sessions with them, and also we have this thing, this organization in Singapore called Very Special Arts, which is also a branch of the Very Special Arts, started in the US. And, you know, they used to organize camps, children camps, and there, you know, they would invite me to teach the children to sing and Christmas songs and the like. So, you know, I think music is it's a very curative thing, you know. It helps, it does help me to unwind, and it helps, you know, a lot of people to reduce stress. And I think for people who are sort of, a little more disabled than ourselves, it does help them in their therapeutic progress. So, I would also, you know, if I do have a chance, I will do that again, because it's a very challenging and good thing to do.
Very interesting, Jaffa. Yes, indeed, we do have a number of Cheshire Homes for people with disabilities over in the UK. In fact, it's probably one of the largest organisations which do give residential care to people with disability. So yes, indeed, we're very, very familiar with those homes over here. Can you think of any outstanding examples where you've actually seen the music therapy help people with coordination difficulties? Can you actually see any benefit that this actually gives to people?
Well, I think the benefit is when you see them eager. You go the first week and they say, oh dear, I mean, is this another thing that we have to do? And you know, if you like sort of conduct your therapy sessions in an interesting manner, when you come again next week, the first question they ask you is, are we going to do something new today? And I think that's one of the things I find very beneficial. Okay, let me tell you a very interesting story. This is not really music therapy as such, but I remember one day, one time, the very special arts had this concert, and I was asked to train an educationally subnormal boy to play the glockenspiel in time with a computerized keyboard, you know, where everything was already programmed, and he just had to play the songs. And I remember feeling, wow, very apprehensive. Okay, his level of thinking, although he was at that time, I think, 18 or 19, his level of thinking was maybe around 8 or 9, around there. So you can just imagine. That was not so much, I don't know if it is a musical therapy experience for me, but it was definitely one for me. I had to train him, and I thought, what have I landed myself into? Anyway, what I did was, I just said, okay, I just taught him song by song, and he amazed me, because after three times of playing the piece, he picked it up and played it perfectly. I remember one of the songs I taught him to play was Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. Can you imagine singing the song? How about playing that song on a glockenspiel? He really impressed me, that guy. And it was a music therapy for me. Well, but, I hope he did benefit from my teaching you. But those are the things, you know. Those are the experiences which you take away with you, and you can never forget. And these are the experiences that will live with you until your dying day. So, you know, if you go to your music, you know, therapy sessions, and they ask you, what are we going to do this week? And they try their best to beat the music in time with whatever instrument you give them. You know, I think your effort is not wasted. I think it's already very, very rewarding.
I'm sure it is, Jaffa, and I'm sure you were a great inspiration to them all. I've heard that music therapy is very, very beneficial. And again, over here in the UK, there's a big movement in music therapy. Now, Wai, can we just ask you about a little bit about Singapore, because it's not a place that people probably know a great deal about. So just let me ask you a few questions about Singapore. I believe it's quite a small island. Any idea how actually big it is?
Singapore has a population of about 2.4 million. Oh, my, I think I've not updated my... okay, about 4 million. That's how big we are. I don't think we can contain anymore. I mean, land-wise, we don't have much. We live in, most of us at least, live in what we call flats, or what you all call apartments. So, I would say the apartments are like, kind of, it depends on how much you got to spare, I suppose. They can be pretty spacious, I suppose, or not. We have things like subways and stuff like that, and a lot of what we have here is like adopted from the West, like the food, you know. I mean, we have our Asian food, but a lot of the youngsters in Singapore, I realize, are geared towards foods like McDonald's, Kentucky, Burger King.
I think you're a pretty multiracial society, aren't you? There's people from many, many different races live in Singapore, is that correct?
Multiracial, right? Yes, Singapore is a pretty multiracial country. We have Chinese, which is what I am. We have the Malays, like Jaffa. We have the Indians, and we have the Eurasians. Do you know what Eurasians? The Eurasians are mixed marriages, like maybe somebody from Europe and Asia get together and they have a kid, and you know, they are, you know, called Eurasians. And we have Peranakans. They are like Chinese and Malay mix, so they call them Peranakans. But we do have one thing in common: we all speak English, whatever language we are. So whatever race we are, and that unites us.
Yes, of course, and I think England had quite a lot to do with Singapore at one time, didn't it? In the recent, well, not too distant past, actually, of course, as there's a strong tie between the UK and Singapore, of course. And I believe that you also, your laws over in Singapore are very, very strict. And from what I understand, it's a very, very clean environment, because you're not allowed to drop the litter and things like that, are you? Is that correct?
Yep, we are very strict here. We are a very disciplinarian society. We still practice capital punishment for good or for, you know, for bad. We are not allowed to spit or throw litter. We are a very fine country, which means that for doing these things we get fined. And we don't sell chewing gum here. If we want chewing gum, we have to go over to our neighboring country, Malaysia, to get chewing gum. Because at one time, we did have chewing gum, but because people tended to throw the chewing gum all over the place, and it stuck to your shoes, and stuck to your... I mean, I sat on the chewing gum before, so I know how it feels. So they banned it, and so now we don't have any more chewing gum here. But having said all that, we are quite liberal in the sense that we are still able to drink. Our alcohol hall license is very, not as restricted as Britain used to be. In certain areas, we, you know, our pubs stay open until 2 a.m. But of course, if your club is in a residential area, then of course you'll have to close up by 12 on weekdays and 1 on weekends. And well, we are free to do, you know, everything else as long as we don't affect anybody's, you know, any other people's lives. So we are very I don't know how to put it, but we try to balance up, you know, between being leisurely and being disciplined. A balance is sometimes very hard to achieve, but well, somehow through some, I suppose, law and everything, it gets done. Of course, we are not allowed to make public speeches and public speeches against politicians or you know, stuff like that. Well, let's put it this way. Maybe we are not as free as, you know, maybe we are not as free as perhaps the US or perhaps even England or Britain is. But then one thing we have is a very low crime rate. And I mean, you know, that is something that we're very proud of. So, I mean, you know, you give some, you know, you give some and you take some, and I think it sort of works, yeah.
Okay, well, Jaffa, well, when we hear the news, you know, in this part of the world and in America, and we hear all the awful things that people do, maybe you've got it right. Maybe you, in Singapore, have actually got the right approach. And maybe we could do with a little bit of the discipline that you live under over in Singapore, put things right a little bit. What about the rights of disabled people, and particularly blind people in Singapore? Is there a strong lobby to improve conditions for visually handicapped people over there?
No, we unfortunately, this is the thing I want to bring up. If there's one thing I think, if there's one thing that I'm not happy about Singapore, it is that we blind people are not, we don't have a strong voice. And I think part of the reason is because the association that we are with is not strong. And we have no, you know, we have no way, okay, to voice out our frustrations and our needs. It's a very hard grind. Okay, like, let me give you an example. In Singapore, while we recognize, okay, Singapore is not, as I said before, it's not a social welfare state. And we do not expect the government to be such. Okay, and, you know, but unfortunately, they are not helping us in terms of career and jobs and that kind of stuff. I mean, the government is always last to employers. And, but then we are expected to pay our bills, you know, pay for everything that we own, you know. We have to maintain everything, our houses. So it is very difficult here, simply because I think, and this is my opinion only, you know, but I think, honestly, it is because the association here from before didn't make a start, or didn't make a start to lobby for not just our rights probably, but you know, for, you know, even just to explain, you know, that what we want is not for the government to help us, but rather that what we want is for the government to help us help ourselves. So I mean, these are the things that I'm afraid we have to contend with. We are hoping for change. We are hoping it is a very slow grind, okay? In comparison to you people in the US and England, it is a very, very slow grind. And, you know, it comes from the fact that Asians are not so accepting of disability. you know, that is the problem. It is all part of the culture, you know. It is part of the cultural attitude that lands us in this soup. So it's going to be a very slow grind, and only people who are well, you know, who really feel very strongly about these things will try and campaign for these things.
Yes, it must be difficult. Out of a population of 4 million people, I don't suppose there are really that many blind people within the 4 million, so you're probably a very, very small voice, you know. Are you provided with things like Braille books and things like that, you know, and equipment? Is it readily available to you?
Braille books, if you are no more in school, you have to pay for the paper. If you are no more in school, you have to pay for everything that you buy. They will give you a subsidy, but you know that is it covers like probably less than 1/3 of the cost. So you know Wai and I, we bought our computers with our own money. I had subsidy for Windows ICS, but my other software that is not related to accessibility like Sona and SoundWatch, I had to save my own money and buy. So that's why I'm saying even the support for us among the in the association itself sometimes leaves a lot to be desired, and we are really hoping for change in this area.
Yeah. Okay. Is Wai back with you now?
Yes, I am here. Sorry about that. Anyway, I gave him a chance to talk, so yes, I'm back.
Okay, Wai. Can you tell us why is there financial support for blind people in Singapore? Did the government give blind people an allowance or you know, social security benefits and things like that?
For financial allowance from the government, I don't think we have we don't have any support in that area. So as Jaffa was saying earlier, we work for what we want to buy and stuff like that. Actually, we do have charities that claim to help the needy and stuff like that. But if you are not so-called needy enough, you don't get the help, see? So, as for, our blind organization, they do help people who are really, as I said before, who are really in need of the basic amenities like food and clothing. I mean, even clothing are like maybe second-hand clothing. So, we have to fend for ourselves.
Yeah, I suppose people's families, people rely on their families for support. Is that fair to say?
Okay, the blind people in Singapore, those who have families, they are supported by their families, yes. Of course, whereas those of us who do not have parents already, we have to support ourselves. I for one wouldn't go around asking for money. I don't think I would want to do that, right? So, we like to get jobs like everybody and do them well, hopefully. And overall, that's what happens here.
Okay, and very commendable too. Just finally, because we have to bring the interview to a close shortly, can I just ask you how you and Jaffa met, just out of curiosity?
Okay. Actually, When I was young, we all knew Jaffa because he was always, you know, the extroverted one, and he always came around to play with the kids. And I was a kid at that time, and he was 12 years older than myself. And you know, everybody knew him. And, you know, of course, as a kid, you know, we just knew each other. I mean, I knew him as a friend or whatever. I didn't know him well until one day we had a project going on, and we were in the same project, and I got a chance to know him better. And I suppose that's how it started.
Okay, that's lovely. That's really, really nice for you both. Okay, well, I think because the connection seems to be breaking up a little bit now, unless there's anything that you or Jaffa would like to add about anything, about your lives or yourselves, we'll wind up the interview. So just before I do, is there anything that you think we ought to mention or cover?
Yeah, I was just saying that I would like to thank for the people for inviting us to come and speak to you all. It's been great sharing our experience, and I would like to go on record to say that this For the People concept is a great thing, and I think you should keep it up and not let it die. You know, on behalf of YESL, really, we'd like to thank you for the wonderful people that we have met. You know, actually, most of them we met through playing poker, but then it as everything in life, one thing leads to another. And now we are members of For the People, and we really feel privileged. Yes, and you know, if I have the chance, I will try to drag more Singaporeans screaming and kicking into here.
Okay, Jaffa. Fine. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you two, and we exchange NSNs, as you know, and we've become good friends over the last few months. Can I thank you very much, both of you, for spending the early hours of Sunday morning where you are. Heaven only knows how you manage it, but it's very, very late for you. It's even the next day. So on behalf of everybody, can I thank you very much. And if anyone would ask any questions to these two lovely people in Singapore, now's the time. Thank you very much.
Just a wonderful interview, and thank you so much, Jeff Hurley. And yes, we met on poker, and Jaffer is one of the top three or four poker players. And Y.E., it's always wonderful chatting with you on For the People. I miss talking to you lately. And Y.E. is a cat lover like myself. And my last comment is, Jaffer, I haven't forgotten. You said that you would write a song for the People, so we're looking at you, buddy.
Be done. It shall be done. When I finish some projects ending now, I'll do it.
I love your music. What little I've had the good fortune to hear so far, I love your music. It's beautiful.
I'm sorry that the connection was bad at time. I hope it didn't spoil your entertainment and the enjoyment of the interview.
No problem. It's been, you know, an experience, yes.